Hello, and welcome to Freudian Quips, a WPRK 91.5 radio show dedicated to promoting mental health awareness through the examination of popular culture and global current events. I'm your co-host, Dr. Samuel Sanabria.
And I'm Dr. Derek Palladino.
And today we have a very special episode. We.
It sounded like you were talking about yourself.
Did I say me?
Well, that would certainly fit with the topic we're going to talk about today.
Absolutely. Today we are going to talk about narcissism.
That's right. And we have a special guest today, Dr. Andrew Luckner. He is an assistant professor here at Rollins College in the psychology department. And he comes to us via working at the UCF Counseling Center, we met first. And he has a PsyD in clinical psychology. And so welcome. We're excited.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really excited to be here today.
Well, before we begin, can you say a little bit more about your background and your specialty and why you're here helping us with today's topic?
Sure. So the degree that I chose to pursue is one that focused a lot on clinical applications like applied psychology. I was really interested in helping people in therapeutic settings. And it only became clearer to me when I was practicing that I also wanted to be involved in teaching and research. Part of it was because I had this great experience teaching at Rollins about 9 years or so ago as a visiting professor.
Imagine that.
I know. Amazing, right? Yes. Never thought it would lead to this particular moment sitting in front of you two. But I'm very happy that it has, because I feel like the research that I do, the teaching that I do, impacts my practice in a really positive way. And my practice also influences what interests me in the laboratory as well as in the classroom. And one of the things that has interested me since I did my dissertation as part of my doctoral degree was narcissism, and specifically how narcissism impacts us in pathological ways and in adaptive ways, and how it helps us understand, I think, the influences on how we become who we are. And I always thought it was curious, why did I become a therapist? Who would want to sit and listen to other people's difficulties every day, all day? And I was like, I'm that person, but why is it? It led to a lot of questions. And so those questions led me to a great book called Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Miller, which I highly recommend someone reading. And that led me to kind of identify with my chair of my committee that we're all narcissistic in some way. We're all needing other people to help us feel good about ourselves. And how could that potentially cause problems? And so that's where my line of research has been, and that's why I'm sitting in front of you today.
Yeah, you know, that's so interesting that you say that, because you know how sometimes when you go on a website and you read about a particular medical condition or a psychological condition and you read the symptoms, there's this experience that many people have where it's like, oh, that's me, I have that, you know? So I had that experience just looking at narcissism and typing in narcissism just to prepare for today's topic.
A picture of yourself showed up on
Yeah, there was. Actually, I just took a selfie not too long ago. But
are you live blogging this as well?
I am totally. I'm tweeting, live blogging now.
Periscoping, that's a new thing.
Please do not interrupt me while I'm doing that.
I'm sorry.
Okay. So, you know, so I went ahead and typed in narcissism on my Google search. And just to let you know that there were like over 7 million websites dedicated to narcissism. And so I started reading some of them, and there were so many of them that was like 21 ways that you can know if you're a narcissist, or 15 ways you can know, 6 ways that you can know, down to 1 way that you can know. And I read the 1 way and I'm like, oh, that's me. I'm a narcissist. I am totally a narcissist. So anyways, I thought that was really interesting. There's so much information out there on the internet.
It feels like one of those things that you can easily self-diagnose for yourself. And I mean, if we look at all the personality disorders, I think there's a way that everyone can find one characteristics or two characteristics that sort of fit in there. So I do find that quite interesting. But what I'm also hearing, can we call you Andrew?
Absolutely.
Okay. One thing I find interesting is that I heard you sort of start talking about how it's an adaptive thing where it can have potentially some positive influences on your life.
Absolutely. The way we talk about, at least the way that I talk about narcissism, is not inherently pathological. And that's why we have the pathological narcissism, a way to describe when it gets maladaptive, dysfunctional, causes impairment of some sort. But really, narcissism involves the self. It's investment in the self. And it's when we utilize resources to help us feel good about ourselves. And so all the time, we're using adaptive mechanisms of narcissism to propel us into situations we felt we never could accomplish, mm-hmm. or we're trying to, in the face of adversity, achieve. That's because of some narcissistic parts of us.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, we have to also give ourselves up to others all the time. We have to help other people at the expense of ourselves so we can feel good. And that too is narcissistic inherently and not pathological. In fact, depending on the position you take, we need these two experiences early on in life to develop a sense of ourselves that is consistent and coherent, and that we can withstand difficulty because we have these multiple ways of bolstering our self-worth and self-esteem in times of need.
Mm-hmm.
But that for many people who can't, don't have that flexibility to move between these two different needs, it causes lots of problems. And they end up focusing too much on what other people think about them,
mm-hmm.
to formulate their own kind of ideas about who they are.
Mm.
So absolutely, the way I think about narcissism is not as pathological, even though I think that's the common way we think about it.
Sure.
Well, before we go in deeper, let's, just for our listeners, if we can define what narcissism is from a clinical perspective.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So for more of that maladaptive?
Yes.
Part? Okay.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting because, at least interesting to me and my own narcissism, I guess, that the common way that we diagnose disorders is using the DSM, right? Especially in the United States, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And
what version are we in now?
The fifth version.
That's right.
Came out not too long ago.
That's right. And who knows when 5.1 or 5.2 is coming
exactly.
out, by the
they
way.
They were so smart to go to the 0.1 and the mm-hmm. point.
Well, they haven't done that yet.
Well, they will. Yes,
they will. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it has nothing to do with money, by the way.
Yeah.
Just want to put that out there, too. That really the way that narcissism is defined clinically is some sort of dysfunction, maladaptation, or impairment in someone's self-functioning, but it's specifically focused on grandiose ideas, that someone thinks that they're better than others. And so the way I like to think about this is they have an inflated sense of self, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if the self is like a balloon, it's like their balloon is about to pop. It's so big, right? It's filling up the room.
Mm-hmm.
And so someone who we typically think of as narcissistic from a clinical perspective
mm-hmm.
has this sense of entitlement, this self-aggrandizing kind of purpose, that everything is to support their greatness and they really want to have other people idealize them.
And that it's almost like they're demanding this.
Oh, yes.
From their environment and from people.
They need it, yeah. Right? They need this attention in this specific way. It's not just to call attention to myself. It's that attention that's going to further bolster my inflated self-worth.
Okay.
And so clinically, we see that in a number of different ways. A lack of empathy, even though there's been some interesting research about that. We see the sense of entitlement that I spoke mm-hmm. about. We see the grandiose thinking that I am better than other people. We see the manipulation of others so that other people are put down so I can feel better about myself. And I'm sure there are images of people that are popping into our heads right now, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah,
yeah. a few. And so this is kind of the common way we think about narcissism. But over the past, I would say, 20 years, the research has shown that a deficit of self can be expressed in a couple of different ways. One is through grandiosity, by inflating yourself and deflating others.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is by inflating others and deflating yourself. It's a sense of vulnerability that I need other people to think I'm doing such a good job, and that will help me feel good about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to invest all of my energy in doing for others, helping others, being selfless. And being selfless can also be a sign that there's a subjective experience of emptiness, that I don't feel like I can be my own person. I need others to feel good about myself. And it's just expressed in two different ways.
Now, how is that different than dependency, codependency?
That's a great question, right? So dependency, at least for me, you please let me know if you guys have other thoughts about it. Dependency often involves the ability to form a connection with someone else, right? There's that yearning for intimacy. The person with vulnerable narcissism is using others as an extension of the self. They see others to be manipulated so that I can feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, there isn't that sense of connection, that want for closeness, even though it may seem that way. Closeness is really secondary to others recognizing their greatness, recognizing their ability to be there for others. And they constantly feel like others aren't recognizing them for who they are.
Wow. That's a great distinction there. And it, as soon as you said it, it clicked for me and made a lot of sense.
So I guess my question is, when we're looking at vulnerable narcissism, are they anticipating, these individuals anticipating that it's a one-to-one ratio, that I'm going to give so much to you with the expectations that you're going to give back to me or thank me? And if that doesn't happen, if they're not if it's not returned back to them, how do they maintain a sense of self at the level that they need it?
They don't really, right? So people with vulnerable narcissism actually experience more dysphoria. Like they express their sadness and they have a lot of envy towards other people and what they're able to accomplish, but they hide it.
Mm-hmm.
They keep it inside more often than the person who's grandiose, in part because their deflated sense of self serves the purpose of still needing other people, of focusing on others to support them. But of course, there aren't enough people in the world.
Right.
And they're constantly seeing other people as not recognizing them effectively. And so another distinction, which is great, kind of related to your first comment, is that people who tend to be more dependent choose one person or a few select people that they can't be without. Someone who's more vulnerably narcissistic tends to spread their net wide. They want to have as many people as possible who might give them what they're yearning for, which is that recognition and that sense of purpose and meaning.
And potentially with the knowledge that they know they're going to exhaust certain support systems, or do they not know that?
No, they don't. That's the sad part, right? Yeah. That they believe that this next person, this will be the person that will recognize me.
Okay.
This will be the person that I can help perfectly, right? And they will see that I'm the best helper, the best person that can be there for them, and yet they constantly feel like they're not getting those needs met.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, I think about a philosophical approach to moral development, which is egoism. And the egoist, the person who subscribes to this belief system, would say that everyone is self-serving. Everyone who sacrifices of themselves gets a gain in return. So wouldn't everybody be guilty of this description of narcissistic, adaptive narcissistic behavior?
I love this philosophical discussion because I just got into this with my students. I said, can anyone be truly altruistic, right?
Right.
That altruism at its heart, even if it's anonymous, serves a function of the self, right? Or why would we give?
Exactly.
You know, is there any selfless giving truly? Or do we want to believe that it's selfless? Because that too is an extension of ourselves. If we believe we're being selfless, it supports our grandiose self, our sense of importance, that we're better than other people. And so I think it's a great question, but it comes right back to maybe everyone is narcissistic, but and yet there are also these maladaptive narcissistic variations, right? The pathological types, which interfere with functioning. And part of what can help us is to recognize our own narcissism and to identify it and to see if it's appropriate given the context.
Yeah, I absolutely appreciate how you distinguish the two, because it's funny, because one of the questions that I have listed for later is, are there any benefits to being a little bit narcissistic? And you just answered that question. Absolutely. There's ways that we can use it to better ourselves, to better society, and ways that it's very destructive in relationships.
So now I found three levels of narcissism. Potentially. So you tell me if I'm hitting on something here. Because I like this thought of that we sort of all have this potential, you know, characteristic within us, but it can be very healthy. It's almost like the word has just such a negative label on it.
We throw it around.
Yeah. And whenever you mention
easily,
someone connected to the word, it's always you're bad or there's something wrong with you. So three levels. One is an optimal level of narcissism, which would be an individual who is energetic, who is self-assured, but is not expecting any special treatment from anybody. It's someone that's basically using this energy to sort of help maintain their functional and healthy living.
Mm-hmm.
The second one would be an adequate, who has some confidence, still has the energy, is emotionally vulnerable and favors special treatment. So they're not actively seeking it, but when it comes along, it feels really good to them. So that might sort of push them to act in certain ways. And the last one, I think, is one that you mentioned earlier, Andrew, was disordered, where it has a grandiose sense of self-importance, demands special treatment, and there's a level where there's a lack of empathy. So does that sound like that fits how we can look at the different levels of narcissism?
Yeah, it's interesting that, not to get too much into like clinical literature, and sure, please just tell me to shut up if I need to, that certainly fits within kind of a more dimensional approach, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, to understanding personality in general and probably narcissism more specifically, that we have kind of an optimal level of functioning. And I would add to kind of your description, it's not only optimal in terms of the grandiose self, but also optional in terms of the what would be called the idealized self, the vulnerable part of us, the part of us that can give ourselves up to others, that can say, I need help. You know, I don't always need to do it on my own. That sometimes I need to say, I need other people's support in order to feel good about myself. I need people to prop me up,
mm-hmm,
right?
But there's an awareness connected.
Absolutely.
To that. Yeah.
Yes, and that's the key point, right? An awareness and an intentionality to it. Like at times, even if not in the moment, I'm aware after the fact that I was maybe using someone else to help me feel better, and then to evaluate whether that's appropriate or not, or whether that's something that fits, mm-hmm, based on the, as I said before, the context.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's kind of that middle part where there's more ambivalence, right? They want to, they have either a propensity to be more grandiose or more vulnerable, to be more inflated or deflated. And yet they still have that kind of wish that's not necessarily pathological to be admired, recognized, noted for their greatness, whether, mm-hmm, it be their greatness because of who they are or the greatness of what they can do for others. And then the third certainly fits with that pathological piece.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So why don't we separate the two? As far as the title, I mean, we use narcissism to explain or label somebody who is maladaptive and, mm-hmm, somebody who uses it in a way that it is adaptive. Why do we have the same word for both categories? Why don't we just have narcissism as the clinical term to mean maladaptive behavior and then something else?
That's a good question. I think the challenge to the unidimensional idea that narcissism is only grandiosity is relatively recent. And as you know, paradigms, it takes a long time to shift,
sure, mm-hmm,
especially with language, right? I talk about this all the time, that we're never calling someone narcissistic and meaning something positive. It's always something negative,
exactly,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually a judgment or a criticism of somebody else, either that we're viewing or that we're in a relationship with. So I think it takes time to kind of get the word out that maybe narcissism isn't a unitary construct. It's not just this one idea.
Right.
And that we need to accept our own narcissism in order to challenge grandiosity and vulnerability, in, mm-hmm, order to feel like we can flexibly use these methods of being to improve our mental health, not just to keep us down or to make us feel better or different than others.
Yeah, and I can see how that could be challenging for our society, because it would require a lot of effort, work, to make those social consciousness changes. Because if you were to say, oh, there's a little bit of narcissism in you, I would be very defensive. I'd be very angry. So, no, I'm not.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Well, look, I mean, Greek mythology, we have Narcissus, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's everything based off of that story is not a positive outcome. So, I mean, and that's our pop culture piece of it.
Yeah.
So they need to focus more on that little known mythological individual from Greek history, Narcissus.
Mm-hmm.
I totally made that up.
Yeah, okay.
But no, I guess what I'm saying is that's our historical context, is this figure.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people sort of connect today's terminology where it came from, it's a lot of work to sort of rename and configure the definition or the multiple definitions of this one concept.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What's interesting, though, although you're joking about the Nicesis part, is there is a little known, I'm not a Greek mythologist, and I try not to play one on radio either, but I will for a moment. So there's the myth of Echo. And when I talk about narcissism, I always bring up Echo as an interesting foil, because we always think about Narcissus and staring into the water and becoming a flower, becoming obsessed with his own image. That there's this other kind of complementary myth of Echo, who lost her voice, right? That's the whole idea behind the definition of Echo. And she was kind of doomed to repeat what other people say because she was told that her voice was negative by other people. And she falls in love with Narcissus, who's looking into the water. And yet Narcissus wants nothing to do with her, and yet she continues to repeat what he says. And so it's this interesting kind of relationship between these two mm-hmm. myths, one of which we know about and one of which has defined our understanding of narcissism, and the other, which is very related to vulnerable narcissism, someone who feels like they can only do what other people do and say what other people say so that they can think good about them, that's missing.
Fantastic analogy, yeah, fantastic yeah. story. I want to sit in your class.
Yes, I don't understand why people would want to do that, but I appreciate that very much. But that too is my own.
You captivated me. Yeah. That was a fantastic story, great analogy.
I'm going to tell my wife about Echo tonight.
Yeah.
Well, I'm aware of my own vulnerable narcissism in this particular moment that I'm having difficulty with your compliments, but thank you very much.
Well, let's focus a little bit on the maladaptive side of narcissism, and let's talk a bit about that. And so you gave a very brief definition of what that is. How does one become that maladaptive narcissist?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And best answer is we don't really know, right?
Yeah.
That's, most when it comes down to etiology, it's like, maybe it could be this, and sometimes it's this, but it really depends a lot on environmental and sure. genetic factors, right? It depends on the theory you go with. So a lot of people have done a lot of parental blaming in the past, which mm-hmm. has come under some criticism, and yet it can also be ignored that sometimes children of narcissistic parents develop maladaptive narcissism. Sometimes it's been blamed on cultural factors, which I think we'll talk a little bit about today, kind of mm-hmm. rising levels of narcissism and the increased focus on individualism that's especially prevalent in Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
We see higher rates of narcissism in Western culture compared to more collectivist cultures, even though I would say narcissism is probably just defined a little differently.
That's hard to swallow, I'm mm-hmm. sure. Yeah.
Yes, okay. It is. And then some of it's been tied more recently to technology and how much focus there is on presenting our perfect self to the world, filtered, mm-hmm. right? And edited, manicured, some would say,
mm-hmm.
As the good, grandiose narcissist typically is, right? Looking good to other people without much depth. But really, it's variable, right? Sometimes we see people in clinical practice, and maybe you guys have too, who have kind of some grandiosity, even if it's not very severe, mm-hmm. that doesn't necessarily have to do with parental concerns. It could be some stressor that happened or something that kind of, some experience that related to high levels of criticism or judgment in the person's life.
So mm-hmm. it becomes like a trigger to make them protect and take care of themselves even more than they have previously.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in many ways, what's interesting about it is it's a protection of the self, but it's also a denial of the self, right? Like, so key to narcissism is emptiness, that I don't really have a true me. And instead, I have to depend on other people to feel like I'm real, I'm alive, mm-hmm. right? Without other people, I don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes we see in the histories of people who struggle with pathological narcissism, either someone in their life who has denied their existence or someone who's put their existence on a pedestal, someone who's put them into high importance.
Mm. Well, you know, as a parent of a single child, I often wonder about my parenting style and how I'm affecting my daughter. And, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I have a six-year-old, and so she has two dads.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a lot for us to have her. a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And we were so excited to have her. And I know for myself, I dote on her a lot. I love her, hug her, squeeze her, anything that she wants. I'm there for her. And there's mm-hmm. a part of me that wonders, wow, am I nurturing a narcissist in this? Although, you know, as a six-year-old, she's developing her personality. She's already developed her personality. There is no signs of that, but there's still that concern as a parent. You know, in particular, her being a single child.
Well, your fear of her becoming you is very...
and that is another concern that I have, absolutely.
let me share. I witness your Facebook pages and how you talk about Lucia mm-hmm. In a very healthy way. And you know, to me, it shows that you just have so much love for her. So I don't experience you in that way. But I guess putting myself in those shoes with Miles, I could probably feel the same way about myself, and that I am showing this kid so much attention. But also, they're at developmental levels that they need that attention mm-hmm. and they need that safety and security to feel like the world is not harmful for them, that the world is predictable and the world is safe for them.
Now, Andrew, did you just notice how we turned the conversation back to us, okay?
That's interesting.
Isn't it very
back
interesting?
Back to our there adorable children.
So what extensions of ourselves, by the way, our children.
Well, they are.
Supporting our own narcissism.
Yeah, so what does that say about a parent who is concerned about raising a narcissistic child?
Well, as a parent of two children, I don't know if I'm the best person to answer this question because of my
own. How old are your children?
7 and 3. 7 and 3. My daughter will be 4 in a few weeks. Oh. And my own, I share the same concerns with you that ultimately the knowledge of these ideas doesn't change the fear I have that mm-hmm. I'm going to create some sort of negative style in my children, right? Or hopefully that they'll be better than I am. That's the hope. And so I look towards the literature, which is typically the way I think about things. And Kohut, who is one of the really well-known theorists and writers and clinicians around narcissism, used to say that we need as parents to non-traumatically, empathically fail our children in order for them to develop a sense of self. And so in some ways, we can only be as aware as possible of what we're doing and how we're reacting, but at times we're going to make mistakes. And in fact, that's something positive. Mm. That's something that allows our children to actually question us as parents, right? And then to begin to develop their own sense of purpose in who they are, to develop their own sense of, you know what, maybe I don't always need my parent to be around in order to survive.
That is great news because I make mistakes all the time.
You're allowing Lucia to be a critical consumer of life.
Exactly. Right. Who knew I was this fantastic parent?
That's exactly right.
Wow. Yep. Okay. Thank you. That's really interesting.
But the key is, right, that they have to be non-traumatic. Mm-hmm. In other words, at key moments in life, we don't want to fail our children. Mm-hmm. We don't want to do it on purpose. Okay. It has to be in the moment. It mm-hmm. has to be genuine.
It has to be organic, yes.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. right? Purposely failing our children is not going to benefit them, so please don't do that.
You heard it here first. Do not intentionally fail your children.
I know it's controversial, but please don't intentionally fail your children. And then it's also important to come back and talk with them about the experience, right? Not to allow their confusion or their difficulty dealing with the failure being a byproduct of their own sense of self, right? Mm-hmm. They can't blame themselves for what happened. And so in many ways, it's to help them identify what happened and to have that conversation with them. You as a parent are understanding what they're experiencing with as much as possible, trying to keep away your own feelings about your failure.
Yeah, right. I was going to say that the parent has to have a strong enough ego to be okay with their own failure and understand that raising a child is going to have a lot of ebb and flows mm-hmm. and it's a developmental process for the parent, especially if they haven't had a child before. And even if they have, it's a different child. Mm-hmm. So the reaction is going to be different. So they need to have a strong sense of self to be able to say, okay, now let's talk about what just happened between us.
Absolutely. And it not be non-traumatic, right? It not be this, you know, this horrible experience that seems like it's a reflection on the relationship itself, mm-hmm. that all the time we are empathically failing other people because we're in our own head sometimes, right? We have our own needs. And so it's about the balance. It comes mm-hmm. back to kind of what we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
And as a parent, I think it's important to have that same balance. And I wish I could say that I have the answer on how to achieve that balance all the time. But again, that's part of my awareness and growth, which I don't think ever stops.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, in one of the websites, the 7 million websites that came up when I Googled narcissism, there was an article that I read that looked at that actually addressed how individuals become narcissists. And the author, and I forget the website, I forget the author, but said that there has to be a traumatic event that that the person experienced in early childhood that then is followed up with over-the-top praise. What do you think about that? Because it wasn't in your mm-hmm. definition at all, but this did come from a psychologist.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, as you guys probably know, like, to say there's one-to-one relationships between events and then how we react to those events is probably a little minimalistic, right?
Yes.
But I wouldn't say that praise after a traumatic event causes narcissism. That sounds pretty dangerous to me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, how someone deals with a particular trauma event and how we support that person may actually bolster someone's confidence and self-esteem and ability to be resilient, which I think speaks more towards a healthy development of a grandiose self,
mm-hmm.
right? The grandiose part of us.
Yeah.
I would say that instead, it's a repeated pattern of trauma, typically that involves interpersonal relationships in which people are given praise irrespective of the experience. Like if you're just given praise all the time, no matter what you're doing or no matter what is going on, then I think you begin to have a heightened sense of mm-hmm. self-importance, right?
Mm-hmm. So could we connect that to children who are playing Little League and that are getting trophies for not being, not having stellar competence in
that
sport?
Yeah, you hear that as a criticism yeah. a lot about how children are just being praised left and right mm-hmm. for just showing up
mm-hmm.
and not actually for any achievements that they have. Is mm-hmm. that contributing in any way?
I guess it's possible. I mean, I don't know the literature on it. My like initial reaction, like I know this came out in the NFL, like I think Jerome Harrison of the Pittsburgh Steelers was commenting on how he wouldn't let his son have a trophy because they didn't get first place or something like that. I guess it depends what you want to value. Do you value outcome, which oftentimes there's a lot of variability and a lot of times we don't have a lot of choice about what happens with outcome or effort. And I think we all have to make choices as parents about what we want mm-hmm. to value. I think ultimately it probably has to be both, right? I don't necessarily see such a problem with giving someone recognition for putting forth good effort, because ultimately it's effort that's going to help someone when they're in trouble, like to help them continue going even when it's difficult. And I also see that there's the potential for there to be problems if we only reward people who get in first place, right? That seems, I don't know, it doesn't seem like it's really helping us.
Yeah, I feel like you need some sort of reinforcement to keep going.
Absolutely. But I also see the other side too, and I think this comes from a lot of criticism about the self-esteem movement. Like self-esteem became so important, especially in the 80s. Like research like just blossomed. It just boomed in terms of its interest. And then we started to kind of compensate through parenting and through culture by giving lots and lots of praise when it wasn't necessarily connected to the effort that someone was going through. I think that's the most important piece. It has to be connected to something.
Mm-hmm.
I think if someone isn't putting forth the effort or trying to overcome something, then mm-hmm. it can seem really empty.
Right.
But ultimately, we're not always going to get first place, and yet we also need something to keep going, just as Derek was saying.
Mm. You know, it's funny because I really do like the recognizing effort. I think that's very important, and I do that with my daughter. If she does well in an activity, you know, I certainly recognize that, but I always make sure that if I see that she's putting forth effort, whether she achieves it or not, to recognize that as well,
because
I do want her to be encouraged to keep trying.
So maybe the different levels of recognition. So you get recognized for the effort, and I'm not going to solve it all here, but I'm just spitfiring. So I think back to my parents when I would get certain grades, an A would, you know, would be maybe $2. A B would be $1, a C would be nothing, you know? So there is different levels of recognition based off of effort, which does reinforce if you work hard and bring yourself to the point to get to achieve higher, you're going to benefit more from it.
And sometimes you work hard and realize this isn't for me, right?
Yeah.
And that only comes through effort. And that's something I think to be recognized and acknowledged.
Yeah, it's not worth $2 for an A, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think we also need to be careful, too, though, about providing that recognition without there being kind of the reason for it.
Sure.
And the explanation for it. Because I think there's potentially a way to provide the recognition, but maybe what's more important is the discussion about what could have been done differently, or what were the things you would have wanted to, or how would you have liked it to have gone differently, or what could have increased the chance that you would have gotten the outcome you wanted, first place or second place. And therefore, it, I think, identifies how we can feel good about ourselves internally without needing that trophy. The trophy becomes kind of a way to open up a conversation about what works best for you.
Do you think that, I mean, I agree with all of that. And I think, you know, process, reflection, communication, creating children who are emotionally intelligent, I think that it's all great and benefits sort of their process through their adulthood. But are we battling against culture in society? So we can say all these things that we, it's important to really talk about how, what you failed and what that felt like and how you can better sort of think about how you might improve or do things differently. But when every other child and their parents are sort of condemning that child or saying, you didn't work hard, you didn't do well, you don't deserve this, is our healthy way of looking at things going to be accepted in our culture, or are we sort of battling an uphill battle for that?
Maybe it depends on what we mean by culture, right?
Yeah.
If we're speaking about gender, we have all sorts of different expectations for how narcissism can be expressed based on whether you ascribe to a particular gender or not, how you identify yourself. It may also depend on whether we're talking about more that individualistic versus collectivist culture difference, like people who are more like, pull yourself up from your bootstraps, you can do anything that you want, like everything can be done by yourself, versus it's more about the collective group and people relying on others, and it's more about family and group dynamics. So part of it may depend, but I think we're always fighting against culture, especially when it involves the self, right? Because we're always defining ourselves and comparing ourselves to other people around us. And the problem is that we're looking at all these people and we're comparing our internal experience to what we see externally from others. We can't put ourselves exactly into other shoes, which is why empathy is so important and in such a deficit in narcissism, right? In pathological narcissism more specifically. So I think it is a battle, especially when there's so many avenues today to form relatively surface level relationships with other people based on a particular view of ourselves that we get to edit, that we get to choose. And so some of that, I think, has to do with that individualistic culture we talked about before, and some of it has to do with technology and its influence on how we define ourselves and how we put ourselves out there to the world, and then how we define our worth compared to others' responses to us.
Yeah, that transitions to the next question that I have regarding social media, Facebook, Twitter, and how we have an outlet that allows us to pick and choose exactly how we would like to be represented in society. And there was a study that happened not too long ago that showed that people who are on these social networks tend to get depressed because they compare themselves and their posted selves and what's ideal compared, you know, to other people out there. And so let's talk about that culture just a little bit, because I know another social criticism that I hear a lot is that of millennials who are growing up in the age of social media, where they are posting personal lives and their pictures and selfies all over the place. And a lot of people think, well, we're creating a culture of narcissists. What are your thoughts about that?
So when it comes to, like, there's been some interesting research done recently looking at Facebook posts and the number of friends per Facebook account. And there's a relationship, at least based on this research, between both grandiose and vulnerable narcissism and the number of friends that people have on Facebook, the number of time they spend on Facebook and Instagram and other avenues of social media. And I think the part that's really interesting about this from a definitely psychological and a sociological perspective is how we get to choose. We get to choose how we look. We get to choose mm-hmm. what we say. We get to select the parts of ourselves that we want to show to the world.
And we can edit it after we say it, too.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. And we get immediate reactions from people. So we are instantaneously gratified. Our grandiose and vulnerable selves are either heightened or injured, kind mm-hmm. of, potentially. And there may be reason why we try to protect our true self from being shown to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for the most part, probably then increases the chance that we develop a false self, a self that we feel like will get us the reaction we want, and we get to hide the parts of ourselves that we're embarrassed about or ashamed about, or we feel like other people won't respond positively to. And I think that's really interesting, because when you see that one picture that someone posts, they've chosen that one picture probably out of hundreds of pictures mm-hmm. in which they're showing themselves in their best angle or with certain friends or in a particular place. And then the person viewing that also has a psychological reaction because they feel like, oh, I wish I was there. I'm missing out. That's a mm-hmm. new thing, yeah. right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. This whole culture of people who now feel like they're missing out on so much because people are selecting these moments in time that are supporting kind of a false sense of self-importance.
Have you seen that video? It was going around YouTube. It was a mother in a playground, and there was a video. Someone was taking a video of her, and she was taking all these selfies of. And I'm now acting it out on the radio. she's taking all these selfies of her for like 3 minutes straight on this video, probably just to get that one picture. So it is like such a weird sort of culture that
we're consuming.
Yeah.
It consumes you mm-hmm. to get that perfect selfie picture.
And then it's conditioning, right? So mm-hmm. I'm going to put this particular picture of me up or a picture of Miles up, and it's going to get, you know, 25 likes. And then like, oh, I got to put more pictures up like this if I want more people to interact mm-hmm. with me and see me in this light. And if I do another picture that doesn't get any likes, then I'm subconsciously moving away from that sense of self. And that might be more genuine of who I am than what is actually getting the different likes.
Mm. And how many likes is enough?
Right.
Right?
Oh, it's never enough.
Right, exactly, right? For many people, it isn't. Like 25 is then a kind of a baseline, and then mm-hmm. you want more. And what if you don't get more?
Oh, I get offended. I get offended if I post something and I get like 12 likes.
You get mad if I don't react to things you post.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
Like, did you see that? I'm like, yeah, I read it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, why aren't people liking this? What is wrong? And then I feel bad about myself. I feel bad mm-hmm. about that post. I'm like, well, maybe it's not as great as I thought it was.
Absolutely, right? So mm-hmm. we judge ourselves as a great. We mm-hmm. judge ourselves based on the reactions of other people. And then we use other people in these moments to help us feel better or sometimes to make us feel worse.
And it's people that we're not necessarily fully connected with.
Absolutely.
Like if I went through my Facebook friends and took out, only maintain the people in there who I feel like enhance my life on a daily basis, like my connection to them, I would have like 8 people, I think, on there. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't make it, Sam.
Oh, I wouldn't, but, yeah.
No, you would make it. I'm joking.
I was going to say, one person is in this room, and that's 7 people then. And then you've got your children and your wife.
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. So what do you think about this idea of millennials being the selfish generation?
I don't know. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts about this, too. Mm. You know, there's been a lot of research done that narcissism has increased over time, right? And there's a book out there called The Age of Narcissism, which basically talks about the narcissistic epidemic,
mm-hmm.
In which basically we need to deal with this. It's a health issue,
mm-hmm.
and it's being influenced by social media. It's being influenced by the financial crisis they tied into this narcissistic epidemic, that anyone can get as much money as they want, buy the biggest house that they want, even if they don't need it. And they've shown kind of through analysis over time that scores on this particular measure of narcissism that's been used for many years has increased, right?
Is that reliable?
So there's some criticism to this, right? That if you look at this particular measure, maybe so, but is this the best measure to look at narcissism? There's some criticism of the measure itself.
What is that measure called?
It's called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory, the NPI.
And there's 40 items on that inventory. Okay.
It's a forced choice assessment. So basically you're asked, do you more align with this statement or this other statement? And it gives you a score. It's not intended to measure pathological narcissism. It's intended to be used in everyday populations. But it's been used in a variety of different ways in personality research, in clinical research, and it's been used to look at both adaptive and maladaptive types. But what's interesting is the NPI only looks at grandiosity. And so a bunch of researchers took all the studies that were done on the NPI over a 25-year period. I apologize if I'm botching it. And what they saw is that we see increases. We see that there's something happening, and they try to explain kind of why that is. Whether it's particularly a millennial issue or whether now there's just more outlets for narcissism, I'm not sure. That's kind of where I run into. Like, is it just, you know, us old folks saying, look at these young kids with their phones and their computers, you know?
But wasn't that said about the baby boomers, that they were the most selfish generation?
It was.
Every generation before, it's been described as the most selfish generation.
And before this, it was television's going to ruin, you know, and then the telephone was thought at first is going to ruin relationships. So it's going to be the worst invention ever, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And so I do think there's probably some issues with us looking back and wanting to negatively compare ourselves to younger generations, right? Always thinking there's some catastrophe. So I think now, because there's more of an opportunity to create this version of ourselves, which may not be actually us, there might be more of an outlet for grandiosity. And there then also may be more of a chance that we become vulnerable over time to whether people respond to us or not, or whether I need to put myself out in such a way that people are going to admire me or recognize me for my greatness. But that maybe it would have been the same if there would have been similar outlets. Or maybe the ways we assess for narcissism has changed and become more sophisticated, that also has influenced.
I do wonder about, you know, current technology and that. I mean, I get the whole thing about the baby boomers and you know, how TV is going to, you know, like kind of corrupt and all that. But now the item is mobile. You can bring it anywhere. You can sort of fulfill your need of self-worth no matter where you are. And I mean, I've heard from some counseling centers that communication skills is rising pretty quickly as an issue to be that needs to be discussed from there, or clients are coming in with this issue. More than relationships and more than anxiety, because when you walk around campus, you see people just immersed. And I'm a victim of it, too. There's times when I'm going to a building and I'm kind of stuck on Facebook or sending a text or something. But it's almost like you are creating this person or this vision of yourself, this version of yourself all the time now, not just when you go home and go on your computer before there was the smartphone that sort of allowed you to do it everywhere. So I do wonder, are we creating more of individuals that are skewed towards a narcissism now?
I think that makes a lot of sense, right? It not only is about the version of ourselves, we're also very distracted. We're constantly waiting for people to respond to us. We send out a text, for example, it's not even involving social media, and what happens when someone doesn't respond? Right? Or what happens when we see those three dots on our iPhone?
Oh, I put them on a list. I put them on a list. They're on my list. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. So there's all sorts of assumptions we make when we're missing information.
Yeah.
And I think that may not be as much a millennial issue, because I think we're all impacted by that. And we're all impacted by social media in a way that we feel like we need to have a version of ourselves that people will respond positively to. And I think it comes back to what Sam was talking about before, right? The pictures, and they're investing so much in choosing that one picture, and then three people respond or like it, and mm-hmm. it's like, I invested all my time, and it's really, I invested all of myself. And the same goes with technology. Mm. And then when you don't get that immediate gratification, it becomes an injury. All of a sudden, you fill in the gaps. And the way we fill in the gaps, typically, from a narcissistic perspective, it's not very positive. Mm. We either, again, we inflate ourselves. Oh, I don't need them. You know, they're off my list, as mm-hmm. you were talking about before.
Oh, yeah.
mm-hmm. Or we criticize ourselves. We deflate ourselves. Mm-hmm. Why am I not good enough? Why did I not write it well enough? Did I not use the right emoji, right? Like, we have all these kind of reasons for why people don't respond.
And then I would think that that negative reaction, response, internalized response, would motivate that person to either step up their game the next time and mm-hmm. actually go farther mm-hmm. with their posts, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
Well, this is all very interesting. And Andrew, we have a game for you.
Oh, fun.
We're going to play a game now, okay? And we want to see if you're truly an expert on
based
narcissism.
Based on all of your years of knowledge and research.
Yes,
and,
okay? So this is a game. We call it the Narcissist or Not. And we're talking about maladaptive narcissists, okay? So what we're going to do is that we're going to name some celebrities that are in the news now. We're hot. We're talking about them. And I want you to tell us whether this person is a narcissist or not. And we'll tell you whether you're right or wrong.
Yep.
Okay?
Okay, I just want to let you know, this is some sort of free association test, I may say, like mother or something like that. So
okay.
Feel free to interpret that accordingly.
And the first one, Danzig.
All right, so you're ready for the game. This is narcissist or not.
All right.
Okay?
I'm
and
ready.
No pressure, but there are right or wrong answers to this. Okay?
Oh, I was
and
feeling the pressure already.
Okay, we will let you know.
And I'm recording his answers. Mm. We're going to publish it later on every social media platform we can
find. All right, let's see if he's an expert, a true expert. Okay, first person is Donald Trump.
Narcissist. Grandiose, specifically.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. You'd be very specific. And you know what? You're absolutely right. Yes, narcissist. You got that right.
Extra credit.
Okay.
Unless he becomes president and he listens to this, in which case you're not Donald. You're doing perfectly fine. Thank you.
Okay. Kim Ye. Okay, now we are doubling this up.
We are
Kim
creating
Ye. This
a
is
person.
Kim Kardashian and Kanye West. Kim Ye.
Their combined power.
That's right.
Yes. I would say my initial reaction is narcissist.
Yes.
For
okay.
both. But if I had to put one above the other, it would be Kanye.
Why? Yes. Tell me that, because I would put Kim above him. But
oh, I'm on Andrew's side.
You're
he's
on
the
his
expert.
Side. Yeah, okay, go ahead. Yeah, he's an expert.
Kanye,
he knows.
I mean, I'm no Kanye expert. And then I'm an old school hip hop fan. So I kind of reject a lot of, I'm an old guy, right? Mm-hmm. So I can't accept the new hip hop that's out there.
Are you fishing for a compliment?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, you don't look old. Oh, Andrew, you're not old. You're young.
I appreciate
that.
Yeah,
you're great.
You're glowing.
I'm going to be 40 tomorrow, so it's
oh,
my gosh. I just turned 44 like a week ago.
Now we're back on you.
Yeah.
And
see
on me
how
too.
I did that? You see how I did that? That was great. Mm-hmm. Okay. But anyways, back to you if we have to. But
I guess because I'm here. So Kanye, like in the face of all that is rational, he has such a amazing ability to support his sense of self, right? It doesn't matter what other people think about him or other people's reactions.
Yeah.
He's always thinking that he is the greatest.
Yeah.
And
wow.
So I think he's a great example of grandiosity.
He walked on stage to
Taylor Swift,
it was about him.
Yes.
Oh, of course.
Regardless of environment, what was going on, it was about him. That's where he wins.
Mm-hmm.
Kim is making that selfie book, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's out yet. We're not saying it's a great book. Don't go out and buy it if you want to. But that's more about her, and it's not interrupting other people's lives, potentially.
Yeah, okay. That,
I think
that's
Kanye
a very, very good
more.
One. Yeah. You know, I do believe that if you are a celebrity, if you're in the public eye and a performer on stage, you have to be narcissistic. You just have to be.
Some would say politicians too, right?
And politicians as well. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Speaking of politicians, here's the third person. President Obama.
My initial sense is not a narcissist.
You're wrong. He's a narcissist, right? Because he's a politician.
Well, I guess it depends, right? It's pathological, though. Are all politicians grandiose? Mm. Because even, I mean, when I watch even the Democratic debate, I feel like Hillary is more grandiose than Bernie, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So although all might have some sort of narcissism involved, and in fact, we might say we're on the radio, we have some narcissism, or we're professors, we talk for a living.
Absolutely.
Right?
Oh, professors, narcissism, it just goes hand in hand.
Hey.
Yeah.
Yes. I always thought about doing a study, but I thought it might break the scale. Like, you know, there'd be too much narcissism.
Just enter enter into any college and go to their all faculty meeting and you will see.
Absolutely. At display, right?
Yeah.
The plumage is out. But so my initial reaction is, yeah, all politicians do, but on the scale.
He's on the lower side. He's on the lower side.
Yeah, I would say on the lower side. That's okay. My initial reaction.
Brad Pitt. Eh? Did you like that?
I like it.
Okay.
That's good. All right. So it's hard to know the real Brad. It's hard to know any of the real people.
Do we really ever know the real anyone?
We don't.
We don't. Okay.
You know? In fact, I don't even know why I'm talking to you guys. I'm, you know, really.
Are we even here?
My initial reaction to Brad Pitt is not a narcissist.
Okay. How about, and this is our last one. Mm-hmm. So far, you've done really well. You've got them all correct.
Except for the Obama one.
You clarified, and then it made a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, you're absolutely right. He is narcissist, but on the lower end, mm-hmm. I mean, comparatively.
And this is an all or nothing kind of quiz. So you need to get this one to pass.
Oh, this one is an all or nothing one.
Okay. So if I don't get this one,
If you don't get this wrong, then that's it. Your credibility is shot.
Done. Right.
Okay. So no pressure on you.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Rogers.
He's a narcissist.
What makes you say he's a narcissist?
I just wanted to be provocative.
Oh, you were provocative. Okay.
The gasp was worth the answer.
Awesome. Okay, so let's close this up. Andrew, now that you're here and you're the expert, what advice would you give people who know or is in a relationship with somebody who is on that, you know, more of that maladaptive type of narcissism? How can we relate to that person?
It's really hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. I could imagine. But we might have somebody in our lives that we love very much who displays
those. Wearing a red shirt right now. And
it's maroon. Okay,
oh, sorry.
But yeah, what would you say to that person?
Well, you know, as I said before, like, it's really hard for people who are pathologically narcissistic to maintain relationships over time. Sometimes what we'll find is that people who are more grandiose have relationships with people who are vulnerable, because the grandiose person can put down the vulnerable person will continue to support the grandiose person because they want to feel loved or supported or liked or something like that. And so most of the struggles do come in interpersonal relationships with people who struggle with narcissism. And so for me, it's almost like the killing them with kindness, right? As a listener, as a person who cares about someone, it's to be empathic about their narcissism, right? Which is so hard to do. When someone is so full of themselves, it's almost being like, I understand why you're full of yourself. I understand why you would say that. I understand why you'd put me down in this moment.
It sounds exhausting.
It is. It's extremely exhausting. And even as I sit here, I recognize that when I see individuals who are struggling with narcissism in practice, it's very tiring and it's hard to remind myself of. And it is the number one reaction that therapists have with people working with narcissism to be burnt out. I just can't continue to defend myself. I can't continue to take on this barrage of criticism if the person's dealing with grandiosity. But ultimately, empathy and understanding ends up being the most helpful if you can withstand it. But then it gets to the point of, is this relationship worth it given where the person is at? And so sometimes it involves breaking ties, ending relationships, while also still trying to be there for support when the person crashes. Because sometimes people who are grandiose have what's called a narcissistic injury, right? They have this, like, this depth of despair that is devastating to them because the reality of their greatness is false. And so there's something that happens in their life where they can't defend themselves anymore. And so they go very deeply into depression. They are very, very wounded. And it's in those moments where you can often then offer support and then provide kind of what can't be provided when the person is defending against their own weakness. For someone who's more vulnerable, it's trying to support their independent self, right? Saying, you don't always need to be there for me. I accept you for who you are, even if you can't always be there, even if you're not always perfect. And to really try to help them feel like they don't have to always be there for others. That having a self does not mean you need to be selfless. And I say this all the time. Because so many people feel like if I focus on myself and my own needs, I'm being selfish. That's not the case. Mm-hmm. Having a self means sometimes you need to make decisions about when you can meet your needs and when you can't. And so ultimately, as a person who cares about someone who is vulnerable, it's really trying to support them getting their needs met.
Mm. Awesome. Well, let me tell you, the empathy part I can relate to, and it's an ongoing theme with us. You had mentioned that sometimes it's intolerable and you have to decide whether you can continue with the relationship or not. I'm so glad that you said this, because sometimes you cannot end that relationship, especially if you're working with somebody, if you have a coworker or an employer who has these symptoms, these tendencies. You know, Derek works with me. He cannot not work with me, so he has to put up with me.
Yeah.
So this is
but
very
I love
good.
It. Okay. Yeah, but also you look at, you know, families that don't want to break up based off because they have children. There are some realities that kind of keep people in these relationships. And it does become an exhaustion in trying to figure out, how can I maintain this relationship, have them be happy and have me feel happy and healthy too?
Mm-hmm. And sometimes the best way to get someone to get help is to not ask them to see someone based on the narcissism, but based on some secondary reason.
Mm-hmm.
They've gotten in trouble at their work, or there are relational concerns. And that can be the avenue to get someone to help. And then it could take some time for the therapist to work with the person to get at the more primary and underlying problems.
I like that. Yeah, it's very, very... Sneaky.
Yes, but it's psychology for good, not for evil.
Yeah,
your power for good.
Well, thank you for captivating us today. This was amazing.
Oh, you guys are awesome. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Well, we do our little takeaway. Derek, what's your takeaway for today?
My takeaway is I love myself.
And that's okay. It's a healthy way. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, my takeaway is, Andrew's laughing at that. my takeaway is, hey, I had this realization that we are all narcissists in some level and some degree. And that's okay, too.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Great.
Well, thank you, Andrew, for being here. We really appreciate this. I actually learned a lot. Fantastic. Wow.
So thanks again for listening to Freudian Quips on WPRK 91.5 FM, Rollins College Radio. Be sure to check us out on Facebook and Twitter. We can interact with the show, and we'll interact right back with you with a nice long hug for hours and days. Well, that's a long hug. Let's not do that long of a hug. Okay, well, until next time, I'm Dr. Palladino.
And I'm Dr. Sanabria.
And I'm Dr. Luckner.
Be mentally healthy and word to your edible complex.
Listening to
WPRK
91.5 FM.
The best
in basement radio.
WPRK.
WPRK.
Yes, it's